The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
If you were to take up the writings of Aristotle and look at man as Aristotle sees him, you'd find that famous definition of man in Aristotle, which maybe some of you know. I would suspect man is what? He's a rational animal. He's a thinking, upright animal. Now, that doesn't help you very much, though, in terms of some little closer ways of looking at man. Aristotle's kind of his feel for man. And so if you take up, say, the Ethics, and you look in there, and including his aesthetics writings, you'll find that Aristotle's view of the hero is very instructive. Let's see, what's the Greek word for it? Aretes? Is that right? It's the word translated in King James, virtue, in the that list there in 2 Peter, the lists of, if somebody's got a Greek Testament, you can look it up. Anyway, Aristotle uses that word in a radically different way from the Christian use of the same term. The hero, or the man who's the ideal man, is someone who acts like a lord. He has a lot of life energy. He's tall, broad-shouldered, arrogant, and he swaggers. And he throws his weight around. He's got, in terms of the earlier part of the course, he has machismo. And so that's the kind of man that he admires. And if you look for a biblical character who fits in that, someone who's head and shoulders above others, you'd think of King Saul in the Old Testament, who's very much aware of his honor, isn't he? If you eat anything, I've taken a vow, you eat now, and I'll take anyone's life who breaks my vow. You know, that kind of conceit of kings, if you will. And so that kind of person, Aristotle speaks quite frankly of him in an admirable way, or an admiring way. Now, the person that Aristotle doesn't think about much about is the slave. The slave is a kind of a sub-man, a non-man, and the distinguishing thing about the slave in Aristotle's Ethics is that he's property-less, he is right-less. In fact, he is property, and he's to have no will but his own. And he becomes a good slave when he comes to the place that he has absorbed completely his master's will into his own, and so that he no longer has a will. So that's kind of Aristotle's view of man. And then, of course, he has a view of tradesmen. He doesn't set them any much higher than, say, Plato would. But against that background, you have the conclusion that not too many men matter. There are not a lot of people who can swagger around and get away with it. You know, quite a few people try, but, you know, it doesn't work permanently. And so it's an awful lot of people end up with the majority slaves. And so there's a kind of a contempt here for man. And you just wonder then how the biblical answer, what is the biblical answer? And that brings us right away to the biblical teaching on the heart. And what I'd like to do is say that it's this that more than anything else accounts for the peculiar form of Western literature. I mean modern Western literature. The biblical teaching on the heart. And there's one thing about it that is very central, and this teaching about the heart is that something about man really makes him matter no matter who he is. He has something called a heart. Now, if in the language of the Bible, if you don't have a heart, you're a fool. The fool is the man literally without heart. Did you know that? I don't know how it's translated in the King James. It's without understanding is how it's translated in Proverbs. But literally, it's without heart. He's got no center to his being, is really what he's saying. And so, in the Bible approach then, there is a radical break with practically every culture, because I think every culture, pretty much there's a tendency to look at it like this. We are the people. What does Cheyenne mean? The people. See? Who are the Chinese? The people. Who are the rest? The semi-people or the non-people. And within the people, you have those people who are really people and those who still are only semi-people. But in the biblical teaching of man having the image of God or the heart, there's something really unique. Now, what is the biblical teaching here? Well, one way of putting it would be, one that's familiar to us is simply saying that man has a self or a soul, which is an immediate relationship with God. It's another way of saying divine image. But we've said it another way tonight, just to indicate that the self or soul, even if this is the heart of a slave, it's still important. It makes the man important, no matter who he is, where he is. Now, you can miss the radical character of that teaching. You just heard something that was revolutionary in world history again. And it's this biblical teaching. And why it doesn't seem so revolutionary to us, brought up, as it were, in our kind of culture, is that we have come to accept this. Everybody accepts the idea of a heart. Now, even unbelievers, who would mean something different in speaking of it, they still would understand us. But if you'd go purely to a pagan culture, you might have a problem communicating exactly what you meant. All right, now, I just point out that how this distinguishes Western literature, and it makes possible a writer like Henry James. Now, Henry James is a super refined writer. And if you found him boring reading The Beast in the Jungle, that's all right. A lot of other people have found him boring. And one of the reasons he's so boring is that he's always writing about the fine shades of thought and feeling in the heart. He's the writer of the inner life. And the pagan world just didn't have that kind of depth reaching into the life. It has very little sense of things getting buried inside of people or going very deep. This is even true of time. Everything in the pagan background is on the surface, and I mean almost literally. Let me give you an example of that. In the Odyssey, when Odysseus returns home, you remember the scene? You don't, you should. In which he comes, Penelope has been tricking the suitors so that they don't run her off by force or something. And when he comes in disguised as an old man, a country man, and he's waiting there cagily for his moment to strike. And the hospitality is extended to him. The suitors have flooded the place. And aged maid comes and starts to wash his feet. And as she starts to wash his feet, suddenly there's exposed on his leg, or thigh, I guess it is, an old hunting wound. Now, what the author does, assuming it was Homer, and I have no reason for thinking it wasn't, since I wasn't there, but whoever's writing this jumps back 20 years when that wound was given. Now you may say, well, there's a picture of real depth in life. But it really isn't. He doesn't really jump back 20 years. I stated that wrongly. What he does, he goes back and picks up 20 years ago and brings that up, makes that present. It's flat, in other words. There's no depth in it. There's no time depth in it. There's no life depth in it. It's just simply the past now become present. It's almost as though that the idea of heart and time are tied together. And so what we would view as very ordinary. They would have great trouble understanding much of our literature, its nuances and its shades and its depths. And this is especially true of American literature, which you would have to say American and Russian literature are preeminently literatures of the heart. Now, in a different way, the heart's used in Russian literature and American, but there's not all that different. Okay, well now, what is meant by this biblical idea of the heart? We've already given you some idea, and if you look at the Bible, it almost is another way of saying the real man, the whole man, wholehearted, you see, giving yourself to something. But it can also be used, this word, in ways that bring out various things in the Bible. One is conscience. David's heart smote him. We would say conscience, wouldn't we, probably? And so it can be used that way. And what's really interesting in modern literature, in American literature, is that the development of people without heart, for us, this is revolutionary. It's a return to the paganism. The actually casting of characters who have no heart. See, you're going to see a little later that the novel came into being through the heart. I'll just develop this a little bit and explain to you how this played a part. But anyway, you get something like Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie. And the amazing thing is that Sister Carrie basically does not have a conscience. That's revolutionary for American literature. A dull conscience of it exists. This is taking you back to paganism. It's what we call in psychological language, don't they call this psychopath, sociopath, the person who is without a conscience. See, they've been influenced by the Christian faith too, and they don't know it. All right. Now, the next thing I'd like to say is that I've already mentioned that the heart could be used in the Bible as the understanding, and of course what I'm really saying is that much of this has been drawn into our culture and literature from the Bible. But I'd also like to say, which is familiar to you, is that the heart is often used in Scripture and in literature to mean the affections, the devotion of a man, and it's often tied in with in the Scripture with faith. Believe in your heart that God hath raised Jesus from the dead, and confess with your mouth, and you shall be saved. And so that includes a surrender at the very center, which would have touched not only the affections, but the understanding, conscience, and all the rest. And so what we could say then, in kind of summing it up, is that various features come to the foreground in the Bible when that word is used, but To be heartless is a very bad thing. To be sensitive of heart is a very good thing. And so, that's probably enough. Now let me just apply some of the what the Bible says about the heart as controlling. You read Genesis 6:5. And let's see, Genesis 8:21-22, and it's the heart that is the source of the evil in the earth that brings about the flood, and the thoughts of man's heart are only evil from his youth continually. Notice how total that denunciation is there. And so, because that center of the man is evil, then all his actions are evil. In other words, character controls action. Heart is the character of the man. It's what he is. It's the deepest imprint of his being. Now, the Bible also carries this out into history itself and rule, in that Nebuchadnezzar, we read in Daniel chapter 4, has a heart of a beast. Are you familiar with that passage? I think the New American Standard says the mind of a beast, but that's heart. That's the Hebrew word for heart. And when the beast kingdoms, See, he's one of these beast kingdoms. He's a beast king, and his is a beast kingdom. They come up out of the sea. They're beastly. And that's why they're all called beastly. But when you come to chapter 7, verses 14, 13, 14, 15, and you get the kingdom of the Son of Man, that is Son of Man. He is one who has a heart. The beasts are without heart. So which is really an analysis of world history. But the power-hungry rulers of this world have hearts of stone, irrational, beast-like. And that bears out what you see in history, doesn't it? There's incredible hardness of heart in the rulers of the world. If you want to read a really kind of a alarming and yet penetrating book on this subject, you might get he's a professor, I think, at Oxford, Christianity and History by Herbert Butterfield, in which he picks up some of this, the hardness of how leaders are so thoroughly corrupted often. Well, it's also interesting that in the Ezekiel 36 passage, the promise is to give a new heart, which is not a heart of stone, but a heart of flesh. So having said that, now let's take this and apply it a little bit to literature. How did it lead into the novel? And I'd just like to say this in brief. There has been a good deal of discussion who is really the father of the English novel. And that kind of discussion can get to be, you know, pointless. It gets to be an endless kind of debate. But you had this series of you had the Spanish picaresque novels. They came into English literature a bit in the 17th century. You had Jack Nash in the English literature, but you really don't get anything like the movement towards the novel till you get Bunyan. And Bunyan is a writer about the heart. But when you get in Pilgrim's Progress, what are you getting? You're getting the inside story of a man's life. You're getting what we know as autobiography. You're getting, as it were, portrait painting of the whole man. Something which in itself is unique, I believe, to the Gospels. You're getting the inner life, which is not merely psychology, but you're getting the inner life of man in relationship to God. And this is the difference between the biblical view of the heart and those who've borrowed from this view, romantics and others, and simply reduced the heart to affections, or like James, made it the conscience and affections and things like that. And so it's in Bunyan in the late 17th century, in books like Pilgrim's Progress 1 and 2, The Life and Death of Mr. Badman, Grace Abounding, especially in Grace Abounding. In fact, you almost think you got a little too much heart in there, and if he'd left out a little of that morbidity, that you'd both been better off as you read it. But nonetheless, it's a sincere account of what really went on in man's life. And so what you find then, we're suddenly seeing a tie-in between the journal, which really is pretty much what you're getting in Bunyan, the journal turning into a narrative, the story of a life, and that being fictionalized in his own accounts of the various stories he tells. Now, when you come into the 18th century, that's picked up by Daniel Defoe. And again, Defoe he sort of desensitizes a lot of it, but not all that much. You know, there's a crudity about Defoe that bothers you. I mean, there's an insensitivity to many things. But he is a son of the Puritans. Because if you go through the Puritans' journals, you'll find that in their idea of keeping the heart, they got often very much interested in details. The idea was if you didn't have a balanced budget, your heart would get all upset and your whole inner life would get ruined, and therefore you better watch out how much money you spend, how much money you don't. And so they would put all these things down in their in their journals. They tended to. And so you have the feeling with the Puritans, not only were they opening up their hearts, but in the process of opening up their hearts, they were pulling out everything. It was in their pockets, too. You know, and they were going through the wallet and all the rest. And the life got really all wrapped into one box. And the result was pretty much the novel. Or to put it another way, the novel was a Puritan sermon that just got elongated and couldn't be stopped until... It really is pretty much, there's a great deal of truth in that. And so the idea, too, is that in the novel, the outer action reveals man's heart. So there's that tie-in. But then the heart also interprets the outer action. You need to see them working together. Now, in the actual history, who's the father of the novel? Well, I would say often the credit is given to Joseph Henry Fielding, but if you look at his novels, like Tom Jones, I don't know how many of you have read Tom Jones. Anyone read it? Anyone seen the movie? Okay, we're getting somewhere now. the whole point of view in Tom Jones or in Joseph Andrews is pretty much on the surface. Now, what you have here that makes it distinctive over earlier sort of pre-novels, there's a clear plot, there's a resolution of the action. A lot of that, though, didn't come in this tradition. It came more out of the theater and out of classical plays. But there's not really any emphasis of this kind on the heart. So I wouldn't say that Fielding is not in some way originator of the novel. He has a hand in it. But I would think that you'd have to go over to Samuel Richardson, the author of Pamela and Clarissa, to see that here is the true father of the English novel. And the reason he's the true father of the English novel isn't that he isn't loaded with all kinds of faults, but he has one thing that really makes him a much superior writer, much more popular in his own day too, than Fielding. But he's a theologian theologian and moralist of the heart. Now, some of it's pretty sickening, his writing. I didn't say it isn't. But the point I want to make is that it has a life interest in it, that what is written there matters. And as these things came out, his novels came out in serial form. I think it was when Pamela was first coming out that... In this one particular village, someone was reading the serial forms that came out, and I think it was down at the village smithy of all places, somewhere anyway. They were reading, and they were waiting to see what would happen, the resolution of the novel, and they were so thrilled that when this happened, they actually burst as a group and ran down and rang the village church bells in celebration of the deliverance of Pamela from... the man who's trying to take advantage of her. Now, the reason for that kind of enthusiasm is that the people identified with it. You could feel yourself there. And you can get the sense of life, as Fielding did, by painting its surface. Richardson got the sense of life by going to the moral struggles, the tensions, the feelings, the attitudes that people have on the inside. And that's why they identified a lot more with his writings than they did with Fielding's. So I would say, for my money, the true originator of the novel is Richardson. Now, the second point I'd like to go to is the biblical teaching on the moral law. Oh, well, let me say this before I go on. The question, why am I restless? And the biblical answer would be that the man is restless, and you see this being traced in the novel, until he comes to have a changed heart, that his heart has a contradiction in it. It was made for fellowship with God, and now it's on the run. The conscience in that heart is guilty. It cannot face God. Man senses his nakedness. He tries to cover over his state by the fig leaves, by the flight from God's fellowship, but he can't get away with that. So man's caught then in this terrible tension. How did someone put it? A man has inside of him a God-shaped vacuum called the heart. So he is designed for life and fellowship with God. The very idea of heart is that of communion with God, and man no longer wants that. And so that accounts for the tension which you find in literature. Now, I just might give you an illustration of how this has been abused by romantics. In the Scarlet Letter, my feeling is that the thematic, the purpose is to really defend the view that if you do it with, if you act out of a sort of a good heart, even if you do something externally evil, it's all right. And I'm thinking of Hester Prynne. She has the scarlet letter A. She has no real conscience over what she's done. She's an adulteress. She doesn't feel guilty. And the idea seems to be, at least on one side of the story, that if you act out of a good heart, in the sense of good feelings, then everything is all right. And so this is a denial of what we've been saying. You have the same thing in spite of everything in Faulkner. Faulkner says the good heart, the heart that feels right, is everything. Well, and if you want to switch over to English literature, the poet who's just filled with this point of view is Browning. It's not unqualified by other things, but if a thing is according to your heart, no matter whether it's objectively right or wrong, it's okay. So this is very common in Browning. All right, now going ahead to the biblical teaching on moral law, why am I guilty? And here, to understand the moral law, you must understand the first commandment. And I'm going to pause for station identification on this one, just because, not that this is so hard to understand, but it's simply impossible to understand unless the Holy Spirit aids you. I think the idea of the heart is a difficult concept, but the idea of the first commandment is sort of off the map. Now, part of the reason we get misled by the first commandment is the way in which we hear it. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. It's natural to conclude when you hear that, thou shalt have no other gods before me, that the sense of that commandment is that God is first, that you can't put anything before him. In other words, you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, but God's always got to be number one. Right? That's not the sense of the commandment at all, is it? The sense of the commandment is God is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and all the rest. That God is supreme all in all. For our God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Deuteronomy chapter 4. The whole idea then is God is absolute. He has no competitors. He is one in the sense he's up there alone. He's God only. And so he's not Lord over a pantheon. And the whole point of that is then that essentially you don't own anything in yourself, but God owns everything, including you. And that's when we say in Psalm 73, whom have I in heaven but thee? And there's none upon earth that I desire beside thee. Well, that's the first commandment. You're responding to that commandment. You're the only one for me, God. Now, that is so contrary to our nature that, you know, it's just beyond us. We just don't work that way. And that is our fallen nature. The heart has fallen, and it has become corrupted. And now we'd begin to see the two things move together. Why am I restless? Well, the clear reason is that my heart is filled with idols. My heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I trust myself. I trust mankind. I trust you. I trust my wife. I trust the church building. I trust Dr. Clowney. Whatever it may be. I trust. And so this path of idolatry means then that we're forced to say, well, why am I guilty? Well, the answer is that I have not seen the profound nature of God's law. And of course, then, it's this commandment that wraps around all the rest. The love to the Lord my God with all my heart, all my soul, all my mind, and all my strength. And my love to my neighbor is like it, because that's just one another way of loving God, because he's made in the image of God. Now, when we say that, then, no wonder this begins to show you how different a Christian biblical view of literature would be and life over against others. For instance, if you look at other literatures, when they talk about law, what you come up with is the idea of revenge. A very prominent thing in literature and sometimes in life, right? What's my name? My name is Stephen. Anything more? Yes, even Stephen. That was the name of a boy who lived with us. We about died. We heard him say that. Even Stephen. And he says, you'll find out what I mean. We did. And he found out what we meant, too. So, but you see, the spirit of getting even, which goes back to the law, obviously it's here in the law, it's built in, the revenge spirit, becomes, you know, in the Greek, let's see, the word is decay, isn't it? And it's justice, but it's iron, impersonal justice that's bigger than the gods and bigger than men. And what it is, let's see, there's another word, ananke, the gods will, that is, this necessity, will enforce justice. The Greeks had any number of views running around of most things, but basically they had necessity up on the top, and necessity and justice went together. Dike, enanke, and below that were the gods, and below that were men. And both were subject in that way. Now, this is impersonal. No matter what you do, you can't escape that. No matter what Oedipus the king does, he must lose his eyes. He must have this terrible fate awaiting him, because Dike and Enanke have decreed it. Now, what you find, you know, if you look at Greek tragedies, you really have the story of human civilization, don't you? Oh, let's see, how did they start off? Anyone remember the story? Somebody seduces, let's see, one of them seduces the other's wife for revenge. He kills the other's children and serves them up for dinner. And they start slaughtering each other back and forth. And these plays then indicate how this works its way out from generation to generation. The Hatfields and the McCoys, done on with style of, and you get the same thing in tribal warfare. You get the same thing when you have a family quarrel, the deep desire to get even. And of course, it never takes that limited form, because it always goes further. And so an eye for an eye is a great mercy when you get the spirit of revenge going. Because most of the time, by nature, we want not just one eye, we want two eyes and maybe the head too. And so people have often criticized the Old Testament on that basis. But that's a great mercy if he only lost an eye, knowing human nature as it is. Well, now, having said that, the Greek idea of revenge then stands over against this idea of the law as the personal expression of the character of a holy God speaking to the heart of man. That originally, this first commandment was beautifully designed for man because he instinctively adored God. But now, he's entered into the spirit of disobedience and rebellion, and his human relations, he's bent again and again on revenge, and he may even feel he needs to revenge himself on God. So this idea of justice is really built into men, and you see it there in the Greek view. But now you also see it in that which has been influenced by Judeo-Christian teaching and yet has rejected it. For instance, in the short stories and novels of Franz Kafka, one of the most brilliant interpreters of modern life. You have also the idea of guilt, very strong. And this idea of guilt finally doesn't come down to the idea of seeking revenge on other people, and it doesn't sort of work that way, but it's more, I am worthless. At the end of the trial, how does he die? Like a dog. Why does he use in his fiction all those horrible figures, beetles? You know, that one that Gregor turns into a cockroach? How would you like to wake up some morning before you go to work and discover you were a cockroach? Well, now you see, that's how he's saying modern man feels about himself, worthlessness. Now you see, what's happened, that man has lost, he has a vague sense of the absoluteness of the law, but he's lost touch of the law and God, which they did with the revenge principle, the Greeks. And so what you get in Kafka is people who essentially enjoy feeling guilty. It's kind of their penance. And he makes sure there'll never be an answer to the problem, because he'll never let man make, on the one hand, either the leap of faith to get to the truth, or he won't let man get a message from headquarters. The old commandant is dead. Or the emperor sends the message out to you and to me, but he died after he sent it out, and the messenger is trapped in the throngs and he can't get through to you. Therefore, you can never get away with your sense of worthlessness to find out how you really belong. It's very modern. We Christians often don't realize that this is the most guilt-ridden age, perhaps, of all time. And one of the reasons is they have all that biblical teaching about the conscience floating around in the culture. You go to school and you're faced with oughtness in a way you never would have been in a Greek or Roman society. And of course, probably the great indulgence in modern times of depression. Now, there are a lot of practical reasons we get depressed, and I don't want to set aside those. But it's a kind of a religion. And it's an effort to make atonement. Someone has said you either trust in the cross, Christ's atonement on the cross, or you try to repeat it. Now, I don't know whether that's absolute, but at least it has a ring of something near the truth, doesn't it? The modern hair shirts that people wear, they're all here. And of course, that's a striking example. But you see, it isn't really awareness of God. It is and it isn't. It's sort of God's second hand. For instance, a young woman came about 3 months ago to our service in Jenkintown, New Life, in Abington. And she wanted to talk with me afterwards. So we talked, and it was really interesting what we learned. She had come from a Christian background, commendable moral character, all the sort of good things you'd want to find in a life, except she had no peace. Well, now, that can come from a number of things. A true Christian who is simply being very disobedient in a number of areas, or ignorant or something of God's mercy. So you could have that from that source. But in her instance, I asked her finally, I said, well, do you feel very sinful? And she says, oh, I feel terribly sinful. I do nothing but sin. And you see, this would sound really impressive, you know. And she must be really deeply sincere. Well, I said, against whom do you feel you sin? Let me put it to you this way. Do you really feel that this sin is all against God or people? And a kind of a little light globe went on in her mind. You could see it lighting up her face. And she said, against people. See, her whole conscience, her sense of worthlessness, which you get, the psychological sense, it's because people have really forgotten about the first commandment, the fear of God, living in the presence of God, and letting see everything stream out of that, And they have become relativized to people. Now, of course, sin against people is sin against the first commandment, but that's not what we're talking about. It's rather people are sitting under the judgment of other people. Even though the other people may not be judging them, they are sitting under what they imagine is the judgment. And so nothing is so deafening to that conscience then than the opinion of other people. And so really what Kafka is all tied up in knots over is what he thinks his parents may have thought about him. The fact that they rejected him is supremely important. But now, for us, of course, what we see is the tremendous answer, why am I guilty, is that I'm guilty because I've broken the first commandment, and that entails all the rest. Notice how the two notice how the commandments pull together in the light of what we've already said. Number one has to do directly with God, right? Number 10 has to do with what? Thou shalt not covet from the heart. You see how these two come together with the themes we're developing. And they both are this, really, they're coming around the same thing. Covetousness, which is idolatry. Colossians 3:5. And so for the Christian then, the way out is for him to discover ever more fully how totally the law condemns him. And to realize whenever he stands in relation to the law, not apart from God, but always in relation to God, that he's wiped out. And the only thing he can say in such a situation is, God be merciful to me, the sinner. That's where I make my identification. It's the way of faith. Now, why do I call it the way of faith? Well, the thing is this. In the confession of sin, which is a daring, bold thing, because the devil and the world and your conscience, everything else is working against you. In the confession of sin, what you're doing, you're owning up to God's judgment. What is confession? Well, isn't that word in the Greek mean to agree with the word? Isn't that the word it means? To agree with the speech, agree with the word? Okay, you agree with God's word. Word number one, word number two, I'm guilty. I own up against thee, and I asked her if she could pray this prayer, the young woman, can you pray this prayer against thee and thee only have I sinned and done this iniquity in thy sight? She said, no, she never prayed anything like that before. And when she prayed it, of course, she was liberated. Because she owned up to the truth. She wasn't just being worthless and guilt-ridden. She was getting really convicted by the Holy Spirit. And so she had to agree. She had to own up. Now, faith is powerful because in itself it really isn't anything. Jesus is the way, and faith is just what puts you in the way. Now, but faith then, having taught you to own up, then it teaches you to disown. Blot out my transgressions now. And so Paul then will distance himself from his sin. God justifies the ungodly. Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. By faith I will own up, by faith I will disown. And he takes it even into his sanctification. When he finds the power of indwelling sin yet in him, he says the statement that not too many commentators catch what he's doing. He's not talking about his pre-Christian experience. He's talking about now the process of disowning. I own up, O wretched man that I am, but then I disown. Even in the area of sanctification, it is not I, it is sin that dwelleth in me. It's not the new man, it is I. It is not I. And so he is very radical then in his disowning. And it's all because that he's come to understand the meaning of the first and the tenth commandment, that they penetrate to the heart. He's guilty all the way, and now the sentence of acquittal is all the way. And so in his sanctification, he does the same thing. Well, that means then, the Christian cannot say, I'm a dog. He can't say, I'm a dog or a cockroach, I'm worthless. But I'm someone very important, I'm a sinner. I'm not a lemon, Now, I know I don't want to overuse some of these metaphors around here, and some of you have heard that one about three times, four, five, six. But it's really important, isn't it, not to look upon yourself as a lemon produced by the evolutionary production line on that bad Monday, which you tinker with and work with, but it's basically worthless, beyond repair, a la Heidegger, thrown into the universe, bent, and the universe is impersonal, and what can you do? Well, that isn't the way at all. Rather, God in Jesus Christ has opened up the way. And by faith I lay hold on Jesus as the way. And not only does in that way do I find total acquittal, forgiveness, but in Jesus Christ I find that He's the truth, the reality, the fulfillment, and the life. And so way is qualified by truth and life and all the rest. And so what I can say then in the Christian is what can be said by very few novelists, that I don't have to end up without a solution to the problem of guilt. Now, we could go through some novels and show how this works out, but before we do that, let me show you the tension that's often found in human life in trying to cope with this problem. Often people will feel the force of law, and they'll feel their own worthlessness, and they'll try to gain some dignity back, and they do after a fashion, by substituting something different from law, which is order. Now, law has an order. We already saw its order. Number 1 and 10 bind it together. But order is where you try to take experience and life and put it into a certain form so that that form will give you meaning. Does this make any sense to you culturally? And so what you get then is ritual in culture after the meaning of the ritual is long gone. It may reflect back to the law. It may reflect back to the cross, which is the only way you can escape the penalty of the law. But the ritual, in one kind of ritual or another, will become absolutely important. My stepfather, who never went to church every Sunday morning, put on a suit and a tie. He never went anywhere. But he had an order, and you could be just as sure when Sunday morning rolled around that he'd put on that suit and tie as you could be sure of anything else. Immanuel Kant was so regulated this way that people would set their watches by seeing him pass by. And what you get then, often in novels, is a probing of the question. It often will take the form of appearance. You get the appearance, the outer order, but then the whole question is, what's reality? Isn't that often true, a novelist's quest? Here's the appearance, here's the order that you see, but what's the reality? And it's that kind of conflict that gives you the novel. And in, say, the novels of a Henry James, you have somebody like, well, let's go back to that short story which you should have read, The Beast in the Jungle. There's a certain order that is in the man's life, and he's really using it, even an order of justice, and he's using it to cover up his lack of love. And, in an English novel especially, order is very important, the ordered life. American novels, this is not as big a thing. But in an English novel, they always sort of got to end them, at least until the 20th century. They had to end with a completed order. And part of it reflects the idea, of course, of providence. That's a very strong feature that we haven't talked about. But it also reflects a desire to have everything in place. And as a substitute for reality. Let me give you an example. Joseph Conrad has a book called Typhoon. Captain McWeir is piloting, taking this boat through a typhoon. Now, he's not a very bright Englishman. I don't mean to reflect on Englishmen in general, but this one is not very bright. he had suggested to him he should go around the typhoon, because a typhoon is a pretty fierce thing to go through, but he doesn't want to lose any time. And so he goes plowing into the typhoon, and the typhoon just strips the ship of everything. And it's in the darkness of night, and it's just utter, utter chaos. And in the midst of this chaos, he's in complete despair. He's thrown away from the wheel. There's no hope for anything. And he's ready to give up and go down with the ship. But in the midst of all of this darkness, he puts out his hand and he touches a towel that's familiar to him. And in touching that towel, of course, order is restored in the man's mind and life. Something familiar in the darkness. And he goes back to the bridge and, or wherever he goes, and saves the ship and leads it on in the way of, well, there's not much left of the ship, but he gets it into Hong Kong or wherever they're going. But this, it's this point that's a very strong human thing. Now, the English are notorious for it, but, you know, the idea of tea at a certain time, and it's said that in sometimes in North Africa they'd even got the Germans in the habit, that they would call up, where it was much more of a gentleman's war, that they would, on the British tanks, that they would telephone to the Germans and announce it was time for tea. And they even got the Germans having tea at a certain time in the afternoon. And so they would stop firing long enough for both sides to have tea. And it was all doing very well until the Australians arrived, who didn't like the whole arrangement and upset everybody. So they went back to a real war. At least that was the version told to me by a British veteran who thought the Australians made a horrible contribution to the war. But that love of order, you see, can be used as a substitute for knowing God. And you find it in the Greeks, this necessity. The Greek tragedy is really a kind of a way, of an ordered way of handling experience in order to purge yourself of guilt. You go along and you die with somebody slowly, you know, over the couple of hours, and at the end you feel better. Your life has gone through that. Somehow chaos has been overcome by order. And it is. It's a substitute for law, and it's a substitute for atonement. It often includes in it some kind of penance. Now, what it does, you see, is to keep man from really owning up before the law that he's really guilty all the way before God, and then enabling him finally to disown it because he's in Jesus. I think that's very close to cultural reality. It's close to our lives. We often feel very shipwrecked if we're far from order. Now, in this matter of guilt, what I would say is really, rarely do you have a novel that takes into account the Christian solution. Robert Louis Stevenson almost got himself in a hole where he had to come to the Christian solution. Oh, let's see, what's the name of the novel? It's his last one. I've forgotten the name of it. Name slips me. Anyway, it's not finished. It's the best piece of writing he ever did. But the solution was so obvious that now, I'm not trying to be sardonic or humorous, but he died before he could finish it. And I often wondered, which came first? Did he decide to give up the novel, or did he decide to die? Now, I don't mean to, because I think he had a real problem in finishing the novel. He really was not a believer, although he came from a Presbyterian background. And in that writing, what he did in the story, it's that of a judge who has a son whom he disowns. The son is a lawless rebel. He disowns the son, and the son leaves where the father is, and since he's legally disowned, he's brought back to the father after he's committed murder. So here is the father sitting in judgment on his own son. And the tension is building up. What kind of a decision, you see, will he make, and so on. And of course, then the book is left unfinished. But here you have the picture of guilt, absolute guilt, father, son, a broken relationship, apostasy, And what does the judge do? Well, the answer in the gospel story is that he gives himself in the place of another son for the lost son. Well, I think Stevenson didn't really know what to do. I could be wrong. But he didn't finish it, and he was really going great guns. And it just stops. Now, and I don't think it was entirely death that terminated the novel. I think it was lack of understanding where to go. The man, and he's also 100% God. The way of blasphemy is measure for measure. We often feel very shipwrecked if we're far from order. Now, in this matter of guilt, what I would say is really... They even got the Germans having tea at a certain time in the afternoon. And he's using it to cover up his lack of love. And, well, in an English novel especially, order is very important. And it's just utter, utter chaos. It's in order to purge yourself of guilt. You go along in the novel. He really was not a believer, although he came from a Presbyterian background. And in that writing, what he did in the story, it's that of a judge who has a son whom he disowns. The idea of atonement in Shakespeare